Okay, so are you ready to go on a little adventure with me today?
Always up for an adventure.
All right, excellent. The Church of Tinkerbell podcast.
Faith, imagination, the power of belief.
Love and acceptance to make the world a better place.
What would happen if we all just tried to see the world through the eyes of a child again, even for a moment?
It's a beautiful thought, isn't it?
It is.
The Church of Tinkerbell.
The Church of Tinkerbell. All right, I'm intrigued.
We're starting this deep dive in the deepest dark of the year.
Right.
Long before any modern tradition had staked its claim.
Yeah.
Forget celebration for a moment and just, you know, picture a primal universal anxiety.
Mm.
Standing outside, millennia ago, watching the sun disappear earlier and earlier. The cold is setting in. Food stores are running low.
And the big question is just hanging there.
Is the light coming back at all?
That anxiety, I mean, that real fear of the sun deserting us, that's the shared human experience. It's the real backbone of the entire winter season.
Yeah.
It's not just about a specific faith or tradition. It's a global story of survival and hope.
So today, we are taking a massive stack of sources and diving headfirst into the historical and cultural origins of, well, pretty much every major winter holiday.
Yule, Saturnalia, Hanukkah, Christmas, Kwanzaa, Yalda, Dongji.
All of it. Yeah. We're here to understand how they are all linked by one central, terrifying, but also beautiful point. The winter solstice.
And our mission is really to give you the historical truth. To show how traditions, you know, they steal, borrow, blend, and evolve.
Exactly. We want to give you a genuine deep dive, a shortcut to understanding the entire season as this complex, shared cultural stage. Not just one story.
Right. Not just isolated events.
And a quick note on our sources here. This whole exploration is rooted in history that's been deconstructed by the Church of Tinkerbell.
And for anyone who might not know, they're all about radical kindness, questioning history, honestly.
They remind us that history is messy, but that human impulse to just create light is universally good. It's a really great lens for this.
It's a crucial lens because history shows that long before any, you know, specific theological claims were made, the solstice was just a serious existential problem.
A survival problem.
A huge survival problem. And humans responded not by retreating, but by gathering. They told stories, they lit these massive, difficult to maintain fires.
And they feasted, the source has this beautiful line, they feasted as if joy itself were a survival strategy.
I love that. It's so good. It reframes everything. It tells us this time of year is fundamentally about a shared psychological response to the environment.
Totally. That first human who saw the days shrinking must have been filled with just dread.
And that dread is tied to one crucial astronomical fact, the winter solstice. The shortest day, the longest night of the entire year.
But the magic is what happens right after.
Exactly. The sun starts to climb again. That turning of the light, that moment where darkness peaks and then starts to recede, That's the universal starting gun.
Okay, so let's unpack this cultural timeline. We have to start where winter was truly, truly unforgiving.
The old Germanic and Norse lands.
Let's talk about Yule.
Yule, or Jol, in Old Norse, was the big midwinter festival. It wasn't just a day, it could last for weeks. It was about marking midwinter, honoring gods like Odin, and paying tribute to ancestors.
And this is where we start seeing the, you know, the recognizable vibe of the season start to emerge. They brought evergreens inside. Pine, fir, holly, what was that about?
It was a visible act of defiance against winter. They were literally symbols of life that refused to die.
Green stubbornness.
Yes, green stubbornness in the face of all this cold and barrenness. It was a tangible piece of hope.
And then you have the legendary Yule log. This wasn't just a regular log for the fireplace, was it?
No, not at all. It was often a massive piece of oak or birch. It was carefully selected, sometimes decorated, and the whole point was that it had to burn continuously.
For how long?
For 12 days or more. It was a powerful physical representation of hope. The source calls it a fiery promise that light would defeat the darkness.
And beyond the ritual, they were feasting. Drinking.
Heck yeah. They were shouting, literally, at the darkness, toasting and basically saying, you may be dark, but we are not done yet.
The continuity is just so striking. The sources show this whole Yule sensibility, the trees, the log, the feasting. It all fused so tightly with what became Christmas.
It's impossible to separate them. And the proof is right there in the language. The Scandinavian word for Christmas is still Jule.
Okay, so while the Northern Europeans are defying the dark with fire and wood, let's shift down to the warmer Mediterranean.
To the Roman world. A very different kind of defiance.
Sanctioned chaos. Saturnalia.
Exactly. Saturnalia, honoring the god Saturn, kicked off on December 17th, and it quickly became the Roman winter party.
Work stopped, schools closed, and social rules didn't just loosen.
They often inverted, and that inversion is the most radical part. Slaves were granted these temporary, really unusual freedoms.
Like what?
They could jest with their masters, wear their masters' clothing, and crucially, they would dine with them, sometimes even before them. It was a massive pressure release valve.
And if you're looking for the ancestor of modern Christmas shopping and party going, this is it.
This is it. Romans spent the week gambling, feasting, and exchanging these small, often whimsical gifts.
What kind of gifts?
Things like small wax candles called ceri and little terracotta figurines. The candles, of course, were deeply symbolic.
The return of the light.
Right. You can see the DNA of gift-giving and decorating embedded right there.
But here is the major plot twist. This is what makes December 25th so historically contested. Saturnalia led up to the solstice, but December 25th was already a massive state-sponsored Roman holiday.
Before Christianity ever claimed it. That's the key. By the 3rd century, Emperor Aurelian was actively promoting the cult of Sol Invictus.
The unconquered sun.
The unconquered sun. Oh. And in 274 CE, he formally established a huge feast celebrating the birth of the sun god on, you guessed it,
December 25th.
So when Christianity began to expand, the entire late December calendar was, I mean, it was already booked solid.
It's a pretty crowded party to walk into.
It is. And the sources confirm that for the first couple of centuries, Christians weren't that interested in celebrating the Nativity. Easter was the main event.
The resurrection.
Right. But as the faith spread, they needed to set a date for the incarnation, and the Gospels don't really give you any scheduling help.
Which brings us to the big scheduling question. There are two main theories historians debate for landing on December 25th. The first is what we just set up, the solar remix.
That theory suggests Christian leaders pragmatically chose December 25th to align with, or, you know, compete against, the super popular pagan festivals.
Especially Sol Invictus.
Especially Sol Invictus. By putting Christ's birth on that same date, they were basically rebranding the season of light, the birth of the sun replacing the birth of the sun.
And the second theory is the sacred math. It's less about competition and more about internal theology. This one is a little complex.
It is. So this tradition, which goes way back to the 3rd century, it posited that the moment of Christ's death had to align with the moment of his conception.
The integral age.
The integral age, exactly. So if they calculated his crucifixion as being on March 25th, that date then also became the Annunciation, the moment of conception.
And if you count 9 months forward from March 25th,
you land squarely on December 25th for the Nativity. It's fascinating, and what most historians agree on is that it's probably a mix of both.
The date made theological sense internally.
And it provided a very convenient, non-disruptive way to slide into a season that was already full of popular Roman parties. It was a perfect fit.
So Christmas was essentially layered right on top, creating this ultimate cultural megamix. Let's trace how the customs got borrowed.
The borrowing is extensive. Take evergreens and wreaths. As we said, pagans and Romans were already bringing them inside as symbols of life.
But the decorated Christmas tree as we know it, that comes later.
Much later. That traces specifically to 16th century German Christians. They decorated trees with candles, or if trees were scarce, they'd build these wooden pyramids and cover them with greens.
And the Yule log, that fiery promise from the north, that didn't just disappear.
No, it just evolved. The custom of burning a special log at Christmas is all over medieval European sources, and the name Yule log shows up in English in the 17th century.
It's explicitly preserving that tradition.
Right. And what do we do when we want to keep a tradition but make it easier?
We turn it into dessert.
We turn it into dessert. Hence, the Bûche de Noël. That elaborate cake is a symbol of that massive log burning defiantly on the hearth.
Okay, but if we're looking at Christmas's biggest modern symbol, we have to talk about Santa. Where do we even start with that history?
Santa's lineage is a true masterclass in cultural blending. It starts with a real person, Nicholas of Myra.
A 4th century Christian bishop.
Right. Known for these secret, radical acts of generosity, famously dropping bags of gold through windows to save 3 sisters from poverty, his feast day, December 6th, was the original anchor for gift giving.
But a 4th century saint wasn't quite enough for a holiday that needed, you know, more whimsy.
Exactly. So he starts to blend with local European folklore figures like Sinterklaas in the Netherlands, or the English figure Father Christmas, who is more about good cheer and feasting.
And he was often in green or brown, right?
Often in green or brown. Then he gets this international makeover through illustrations, poems like A Visit from St. Nicholas, and then big-time 20th century advertising.
And that's where he becomes the jolly red-suited Santa Claus we know today.
So we can pretty much say that Santa is part bishop, part Northern European folklore, and part a very successful marketing campaign. The cultural verdict holds true. Christmas is a Christian feast, a descendant of ancient solstice feasts, and a commercial season, all performing together.
So now let's widen the lens. A lot. Because the winter calendar is crowded with these powerful traditions built around light and family that are often misunderstood.
And this is so important. These next holidays did not copy Christmas. They are independent, profound responses to darkness or struggle.
Let's start with Hanukkah.
Hanukkah, the Jewish festival of lights. It dates back to the 2nd century BCE, so it's significantly older than the Christian Christmas celebration.
And it's not really a solstice holiday, it's a festival of resistance.
Religious and political resistance. It commemorates the Maccabees' successful revolt against the Seleucid Empire and the rededication of the Second Temple in Jerusalem.
It starts on the 25th of Kislev, usually in November or December, and lasts for 8 days.
And the core practice is lighting the menorah, commemorating the miracle of the oil. But the deeper theme is really the triumphant assertion of Jewish identity and religious freedom.
Okay, moving eastward now. Two ancient celebrations tied directly to the astronomical solstice. First, Yaldanite.
Shabe Yalda. Celebrated in Iran and neighboring regions with ancient Persian roots, it means birth night.
The birth of the sun goddess, Mithra.
Exactly. This celebration is all about the longest night of the year and the communal decision to wait out the darkness together.
And the way they do it is so powerful. Families gather and they stay awake through the entire night. What are they doing?
They're reading poetry, especially the works of Hafez. They tell stories, they anticipate the dawn, and they share specific foods.
Red fruits?
Red fruits, like pomegranates and watermelons. Their vibrant color symbolizes the crimson of the dawn and the vitality of life that is absolutely going to return. It's so hopeful.
That focus on balance takes us to East Asia and the Dongzhi Festival in China.
Dongzhi, the extreme of winter. It marks the cosmological point where yin darkness, cold, rest hits its absolute peak.
And once yin peaks,
yang light, warmth, activity immediately begins to rise again. So it's a celebration of balance, harmony, and the return of positive energy.
And this is a critical time for family reunion. What are the key traditions?
The focus is honoring ancestors and gathering the family for a warm meal. And the defining dish is tingwin.
Glutinous rice balls.
Glutinous rice balls in a sweet soup. And their round shape symbolizes reunion and completeness. The name itself even sounds like the Chinese word for reunion.
And while it's technically earlier, we have to include Diwali in this family of light.
Absolutely. Diwali, the Hindu festival of lights, celebrated across Hinduism, Jainism, and Sikhism. It is maybe the largest, brightest assertion that light overcomes darkness.
Good triumphs over evil, knowledge over ignorance.
Right, and the scale is just immense, lighting thousands of tiny diyas, these little earthen lamps, fireworks, exchanging sweets. It's using physical light to remind the community of inner spiritual light.
Finally, we turn to the newest tradition on this list, one focused explicitly on modern identity and liberation.
Kwanzaa.
Kwanzaa was created in 1966 by Dr. Malana Karenga. It's a week-long African-American and Pan-African cultural celebration of heritage.
And it's specifically held from December 26th to January 1st. It intentionally follows Christmas. It was born directly out of the Black Freedom Movement.
And it's built around the Nguzo Saba.
The seven principles. For a real deep dive, you have to know what those are. They are the ethical foundation of the whole thing.
Those things like unity, self-determination, collective work, and responsibility.
Exactly. Ujima, for example, calls for the community to build and maintain its own neighborhood together to solve problems collectively. Kwanzaa is a celebration that mandates shared responsibility.
So after touring Germanic halls, Roman banquets, ancient Persian poetry readings, we arrive back at the core question. Is Jesus really the reason for the season?
Let's untangle that using the history. If the season means the deep, shared human impulse to gather at the winter turning point and mark the return of light, then historically, the answer is a clear no.
The season is much older. It was shaped by Yule, Saturnalia, Hanukkah, Yalda, Dongzhi.
All of which predate or develop totally independently of Christmas. The solstice is the reason for the season's existence. However, if the season means the specific Christian feast of Christmas, celebrating the incarnation, then for followers of that faith, yes, he is the theological center of that holiday.
But the biggest takeaway, I think, is the cultural verdict. Even the Christian celebration is a massive cultural remix.
It uses a borrowed date, borrowed evergreens, an inherited Yule log tradition, and a gift giver who is part saint, part myth, and part corporate icon.
History doesn't show one owner. It shows, as this source says, a big shared stage with many stories performing together.
And that shared stage is the beautiful complexity of it all. No single tradition owns the calendar, but all of them are strengthened because they reflect this universal courage.
The courage of people who stood in the face of the darkness and just kept hope and light and community alive.
They weren't waiting for one moment, they were saving themselves together.
And that brings us right back to the philosophical core of our source material, the Church of Tinkerbell. They provide this powerful final synthesis. The source states, "The true reason for the season is that we are alive together in a dark universe, and we have the astonishing power to create light in candles, in communities, in our own hearts. Everything else is costume."
The history gives us the mechanism that gives us the mandate.
So given all this history we just explored, the Yule logs, fiery promise, Saturnalia's social inversion, Yalda's late night poetry, Kwanzaa's focus on principles like collective responsibility, we want to leave you with a thought. Which specific historical mechanism, which tradition for generating light and hope, feels most resonant or necessary for you to carry forward and practice this year? What light do you need to kindle? Thanks for going on this little adventure with me today.
Anytime.
And listener, keep sprinkling that fairy dust, all right? We'll see you next time.